Sound of Hockey episode 263. We're calling this one the Wayne Simmonds episode. Why are we calling it that, John?
Wayne Simmonds.
The Wayne train.
That's right.
El tren de Wayne. That's Spanish.
Okay. He scored 263 goals in his career.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a good one.
Okay. And he had 263 assists in his career.
No.
True story.
Wow.
Look it up.
I don't believe you. I'm looking it up.
The rare.
Boop, beep, boop, boop. I should say these are regular season totals.
Yeah. We're all way too cheery right now considering the circumstances we're recording, which is just after a 4-3 Seattle Kraken loss to the lowly Chicago Blackhawks. More on that in a moment, but this is Sound of Hockey. I am Darren Brown at Darren Fun Brown on the Twitter, joined as always by John Barr. Hello, John.
Hello, everybody. I'm NHL to Seattle on the X.
And Curtis Izaki. Hello, Curtis.
Hello, everyone. Deep Sea Hockey on X, formerly known as Twitter.
Okay. And don't forget to follow us also at @sound_hockey. And if you're not doing that already, I mean, what are you even doing at this point?
You might not be on Twitter at that case.
Which
is totally
possible.
Reasonable.
Yeah, very possible.
Yeah, but if you're
totally
on
reasonable.
There, check it out.
Yeah.
It's taken some weird turns, you know, in recent months. So if you're not there anymore or you decided.
Today was a weird day.
Today was a very weird day. We're going to talk.
We'll get into it.
We're going to talk about that in a bit. It was a very, very weird day to be monitoring the internet, which I found myself monitoring a lot today.
Say hockey Twitter or
hockey Twitter specifically.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
We'll get back to it
in
a bit.
I didn't miss anything.
Put a little pin in that.
Yeah,
a small pin.
Attack. We're not going to forget to take the pin out. No. Sometimes we put pins in things and then forget to take them out. We had one where we're like, oh, you know what? Let's put a big pin in that, and we'll talk about it on the Patreon mailbag because we know we had a question for somebody in the Patreon mailbag. Then we totally forgot what the pin was and we went back to record that later. So
I don't think we're ready for anything besides thumbtack pins.
What's the really big stake that we have? It's something to do with Matty Beniers. Maybe his face-off percentage. And we're supposed to check
face
back.
Off late in this game, but his percentage was not good.
We're supposed to check back on that, I think, in April.
Yeah. I think
so how's that progress right now?
Pin's still in. Couldn't tell you. No idea.
Right. Okay. Yeah, it's been an interesting week in general. I think from a Kraken standpoint, from a NHL hockey standpoint, it's been a very interesting week. And this is a great episode. We have a really cool and unique interview on this episode that kind of took me back, John, to our pre-Kraken days, right? When we just interview kind of random people from around the hockey world.
Yeah.
But it's a really cool interview. John and I chatted with Blake Jeffrion, who played for the Badgers when I was at school there. So I was very familiar with him. He played at the NHL level, had his career cut very short by a kind of a freak accident playing in an AHL game when he was locked out during the 2011-12 season, I think. They had the lockout going on. He got hit and a skate came up and hit him in the back of the head and gave him a horrible fractured skull. So that ended his career, but he's very open and willing to talk about that. And the gentleman that was with him, Sam Jeffries, just wrote a book about him. So it's a really cool interview. I think you guys are going to love it. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go here as well with this podcast. Kraken talk. It's been a weird week. Like I said, they had a 7-1 win over the very lowly San Jose Sharks. Now, I got to say, though, I have to give them credit because they could have come out and dumped on the ice that night, right? Like it felt like one of those nights where it was like, oh, they got to beat the Sharks. There's no way they lose to the Sharks. And then it felt like
I was a little spooked about it going into it.
I was totally spooked. Sure. But they came out and they looked good, didn't even give the Sharks a chance. And the Sharks are terrible. They are really bad.
Okay. Yes. I thought it was the worst performance I've ever seen by a team in the NHL.
From the Sharks. Pledge?
Period. I don't know. I've never seen a team perform that poorly across the entire NHL, any game I've ever seen.
That's a hot take.
I don't know if it's that hot. They looked brutal.
They looked really bad.
And I'm like, okay, this team really stinks. And then they go on to beat Vancouver, and they beat the Capitals.
Yeah.
In the last week.
I will say that their coach and their players were really pissed off after the game at the way that they played. So I think they're a really bad team that also came out and played a horrible game. And I think we got to give the Kraken a little bit of credit. I think the Kraken played pretty well that night too. So I think all those things combined.
I think that's fair, but like,
and
my God,
it was a really bad performance.
That team.
What blew my mind was just how much time the Kraken seemed to have with the puck. Like the Sharks defense, just all they did was like collapse down around the slot. And then the Kraken could just do whatever they wanted with the puck. It was so strange. Like watching
it
that
game. It
felt
like pickup beer league hockey where one team was dominate like overstacked, right?
Yes. It was not a good game. I mean, great from the Kraken perspective, but I mean only kind of fun though, right? Like it was
you're right. Six different goal scorers, that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Right.
Oliver Bjorkstrand had 4 points that night. Ellie Tolvanen had 2 goals and an assist. So yeah, and then they come back against Vancouver. We had the little Thanksgiving day off, which was lovely. And the second half of the turkey sandwich, I didn't think they played as bad, and you wrote this in 3 takeaways. I didn't think the Kraken played as bad in that one as the score showed, because the final was 5-1. I think they got off to a bad start to the game, and then they had an opportunity to turn the tables in the second period where they were like dominating for the first half of the period. They were down 1-0 at that point. They didn't score, and that's where I think they threw it away, was when they didn't score in that first half of the second period when they were really dominating the play.
Yeah, and I thought that third goal that Vancouver added kind of, you know, halfway through the third or whatever seemed to, like, break the motivation of the Kraken, and it just didn't seem like they had much of a chance after that. A lot of people didn't like my, it wasn't as bad as it looked.
I didn't think it was either.
I don't think either team really played that well, right, to be perfectly frank.
Mm-hmm. I agreed with you, though. I didn't think that they looked as bad that night as the score showed. But you also took some heat in Weekly One-Timers for your takes on the tough guy scenario. So maybe we talk a little bit more about that. Let's go through the games.
Is that pin? Another pin?
That's a small pin that we're going to take out in just a moment.
Okay.
Pin it.
Okay, let's pin it.
Pin that. Curtis, your thoughts on Vancouver. Any other thoughts here?
I think the game was pretty close holistically through 2 periods, and then but just kind of third period they came out again, and it's something that we've seen from this team coming out flat in the third period, not generating much offense when they need it, when they're behind, and it's been a problem in this one. They just third period didn't generate much at all. Couldn't really get back into the game. And then the bounces were, they had to start taking chances. And that's when Vancouver really poured it on. Vancouver had a number of breakaways.
Now, kind of the opposite happened here. They had a few days off. They went to play in Chicago, had a 4-3 loss. So second loss in a row. And this one, I didn't like the way they played in this one at all. I think Chicago's not a very good team. And I think they just looked sloppy in the first, really the first 2 periods. I didn't think Philip Grubauer played particularly well. This game, I do think they came out well in the third period, but it was, you know, it's too little too late at that point. They're down 2 going to the third period.
In the third period, and this one might have been some of Chicago hanging back and trying to hang on to a lead, kind of doing something we've seen the Kraken do.
And succeeding.
Yes. yes, they did. They held on. But, I mean, if you look at the stats, this hanging back strategy is so self-defeating. I mean, if you look at the stats, essentially the Kraken created whatever they did in terms of shot quality in the other 2 periods. It's just Chicago generated almost nothing. Yeah. Hanging back just as it's like the prevent defense. It prevents you from winning, right? It's anyway, in this one, I had a little bit more nuanced take on this one. I thought the Kraken looked fairly good in the first 4 or 5 minutes. Of the game.
Yeah, okay. That's
totally
fair.
And I thought that actually contributed to what happened for the remainder of the game. I think the Kraken came out and thought they could win any puck battle, beat any player one-on-one, connect on any pass they wanted.
Overconfident, if you
because
will.
They were. Yeah. They came out and it just seemed they were clearly superior. And then they started trying these passes through the neutral zone that were not working. They were swiping at pucks instead of like staying in structure, trying to beat players one-on-one, and we're just kind of taking themselves out of the game. We're not really playing with the kind of structure that this team needs to succeed, thinking that, you know, again, maybe this is just a, you know, another San Jose game or something. We're going to run this team.
I honestly felt that's what it looked like the first 5 minutes. Like, so I'm totally agree with you there.
Here's a hot take. Do we think that maybe, because sometimes those games where you really dominate a team like they did against San Jose, sometimes those can have a bad impact on you because you get these bad habits where you're overpassing, you're over stick handling, things like that. Do you think any of that carried over a little bit into Vancouver or even now into Chicago?
I don't know if it carried over or not, but that did kind of seem like what was happening in the Chicago game.
Yeah.
Like they just thought that they could do whatever they wanted on the ice rather than sticking to like the, you know, the forecheck and defensive structure system. And they were just kind of, I remember one sequence in particular that led to a goal in the second period. It was kind of just like kind of a jammed up neutral zone situation. And three Kraken forwards broke towards the Chicago goal thinking they'd gained possession. They hadn't. It resulted in a kind of 2-on-2 break into the Kraken defensive zone. It's that led to the Tyler Johnson goal.
Mm-hmm. Man from Spokane.
The man from Spokane.
Yeah.
It was like kind of a 2-on-2 break out of what seemed like nothing at all. And it was just kind of undisciplined cheating for offense type of thing that happened, it looked like.
So to your original question, I certainly think it's possible that these things carry over. Mm-hmm. Similar to like what you said about San Jose getting pissed off, right? So they're pissed off, and so it carries on to, you know, like sometimes when you're backed into a corner or embarrassed, you have more reason to like practice harder, play harder, and really push the limits. And I think the opposite is true. When you get, you're a little overconfident, you might not work as hard because you're like, oh, we're hitting our stride. We dominated. Because they also, you know, had beaten Vancouver fairly recently.
Yeah.
Not handily, but I think it's possible. I think it's really hard to, like, for us, where we sit and where most media sits, very challenging to, like, really know if that happens without having a really good insight on the locker room.
I definitely do think there's a little bit of carryover in terms of like bad habits from San Jose to Vancouver, though, because there is definitely like in the first 5 minutes of that game when Seattle kind of got dominated by Vancouver and there was this feeling of like, oh, these aren't the Sharks anymore. Right. Like these are
like, uh-oh,
a good team. Yeah, right. Like these guys know what they're doing. So, yeah, I think there was definitely some carryover from the top half of the turkey sandwich to the bottom half. I don't know if you can quite make that argument for the Chicago game because there's a pretty long stretch of days off there in between.
But. Yeah. And you just came after a loss and maybe the long stretch added to it as well in a weird way.
But they did team building. So how can you lose after team building?
I don't know. Because they did. That's for sure.
Build it enough, apparently.
I mean, make no mistake. I mean, this is a low point in the season. I remember the loss to Chicago last year. Felt like this too. Going into the United Center and losing that time felt like how could you let this happen?
Yeah.
The game played out differently.
Yeah.
But it felt similar. It's like 2 points you have to have.
I remember that one. And then, I was trying to remember it. I was on the golf course that day listening to it on AirPods.
Oh, it was brutal.
Yeah,
it made my golf game go sideways. I'm gonna blame the Kraken game for my golf game not going very well that day.
Totally
fair enough.
Yeah. Totally. Fair. But
why wouldn't you?
We'll see how the rest of the trip plays out. But it's not how you want to start a trip.
Dropping two points from Chicago.
Because I don't think there is a big difference between the quality of the Chicago Blackhawks and the San Jose Sharks. I mean, the San Jose Sharks played a terrible game. I agree with you. They couldn't do anything in their defensive zone. They couldn't do anything in the offensive zone. They looked terrible. But like just looking at kind of the underlying numbers, the Blackhawks are not a good team. I didn't think they looked very good on the ice tonight. They converted a couple scoring chances on Grubauer, but I didn't think they looked particularly good.
I thought they looked
good.
Better than San Jose. That's for damn sure.
Well, they certainly played a better game than San Jose did. Yeah. I'm just saying this is not a good team.
Yeah.
And
and they're down. We'll talk about it. Corey Perry and Taylor Hall.
Yep.
Right? Why? What happened to Corey Perry?
We'll put a big pin in that one.
We actually don't know, to be clear. Okay. So speaking of pins, I'm pulling out the pin that I just put in a few minutes ago, the very small pin. Was there a second pin from earlier?
That was the interesting day on the internet. We'll come back.
Okay. That pin is still in.
That one's still in.
Yeah. And do we need to now add a second pin because of what you just said about Corey Perry? I mean, they're the same topic.
It's in the same pin.
Okay.
We'll just attach it, right? Yeah.
That pin remains.
Two post-its, one pin.
Got it.
I hope the listeners are keeping track of this.
Yes, my pin has just been removed, and we're going to do some tough guy talk right now, okay? We're going to get tough.
Serious business.
It's been a while since we've had serious business.
What was serious business? What was that?
Contract talk, I think?
I think it was contract talk. Yeah.
I forgot about serious business. Oh, that's pretty good. We did remind ourselves that we said we were going to do a weekly wager, and we did it 1 week and then stopped doing it. So we're going to bring it back tonight. The weekly wager lasted 1 week. We're trying it again tonight, like 5 weeks later after we introduced it, and then didn't do it a second time. Tough guy talk.
That's not a segment.
It's where we debate if the Kraken need a tough guy. I still don't think they need a specific tough guy. What I wrote in three takeaways after the Vancouver game, because in that one, Brandon Tanev got hurt and Oliver Bjorkstrand took a really cheap high hit from Tyler Myers. I don't think that they necessarily need a specific tough guy. I don't think that that really helps your team's chances to win by any means. And they clearly value that over just like having a big bag of knuckles to throw around. What I do think they need to do, though, is have more of a pack mentality. And again, I wrote this, but I do believe that. It seemed like they had it a little bit tonight. There was a moment when Grubauer got hit, and all of a sudden the whole team was in there, like, ready to go. So
who hit Philip Grubauer?
Wasn't it Ryan Donato?
It was. Yeah. It was Ryan Donato.
Old friend Ryan Donato. And then Grubauer even had his mask off and was, like, having words, which I thought was hilarious.
With Ryan Donato.
Right. Yeah. And Ryan Donato is, for the record, the nicest, most mild-mannered guy.
But he has a little edge to him.
He does have a little bit of an edge. But so that goes back to my point earlier of the Kraken need the pack mentality back, because how many times did you see last year when anything would happen and Ryan Donato would come flying in his gloves, you know, yep. And you're like, he's not going to fight the guy, but he'll at least wrestle him to the ground and say, hey, what you just did was unacceptable. And there hasn't been any of that this year. There's been cheap shots on Brandon Tanev twice now. I don't think this most recent one was all that cheap because he had the puck handed over and then got nailed. But still, it's a big hit. Your player got hurt. Andre Burakovsky, I think, was arguably that was a cheap shot from Trouba. We threw him into the boards from a dangerous spot. Now, Tyler Myers is 6'8", so I don't really.
Trouba, man. Who's going to take on Trouba?
That's a good point. Good
scary.
Point. But then what about the McCann one, right? Andrew Mangiapane's not a big guy. Like, somebody's got to go after some of these guys. Like, you can't, I just don't think that you can like let these things slide that are so blatantly cheap shots. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But I do think that the one good thing that came out of this Blackhawks game was that sequence where the whole team got in there. A number of unsportsmanlike penalties were handed out as a result. I thought there was a decent response there.
Tonight. But I think that might be a response to the lack of response.
Too. No. I agree completely. Maybe that was part of the team building. Maybe there was kind of discussions to this effect.
Fight club?
And maybe there was a fight club.
We can't talk about that.
But I'm at least somewhat optimistic that maybe moving forward, we'll see a little bit more of that. If there is a hit that someone doesn't like, there'll be more of this kind of pack approach like there was tonight. Because it looked like you could imagine Ryan Donato, he was just sticking his stick in there to get a puck that he thought was loose on Philip Grubauer, turned into mayhem.
Yeah.
And that might not have happened three games ago.
I don't think so. Yeah. I don't think it would have. I did ask Dave Hakstol if he would have liked to see a physical response after the Tanev hit, and he said, it depends on the situation, but I won't get into that. So that
I think he kind of like was like, yes, but I think can't say that.
I think so too. Yeah. But I don't know. Reading between the lines, I thought the no comment was a little bit of a comment.
I agree. Yeah. And so that makes you think maybe the Fight Club don't talk about Fight Club conversation happened during these 2 days off.
Well, I also don't think it's a coincidence that at the end of that Vancouver game, all of a sudden now Ty Cartier is going after Nils Höglander and Yanni Gord drops the gloves with Teddy Bluger. I don't think that that's a coincidence, right? I think that the coach recognized, hey, that's two cheap shots on our guys here and you guys haven't done anything about it. That's what I think.
So the Cartier...
That's my own take. I didn't hear that from anybody, for the record.
Two cheap shots. I still don't think the Höglander was a cheap shot.
Okay, well, whatever. A hit that injured our player. Injury.
Fair enough.
And it was very similar to the hit that injured him the first time this season, right?
Fair enough.
So there should be a response.
Yeah.
That's just how it is in hockey these days.
I agree.
And I don't mean, it doesn't have to be two guys dropping the gloves and going toe-to-toe and having a whole fight. I don't care about that. I don't even like fighting that much. Like, but there should be those kinds of the melee that we saw tonight, right? When Donato hits Grubauer or even touches him, there's a big brouhaha in the corner. Those are the kinds of things that you should see.
This is off the top of my head, but I think Yanni Gord, Ty Cartier, and actually Jared McCann have been the only three that have kind of mixed it up in these situations so far this year. So it's not surprising.
Somebody didn't read their Monday
Vince
musings.
Dunn. Well, you're saying fighting majors, though.
Yeah, that's true.
He's not necessarily saying
fighting
majors.
I'm not saying like square up and fight, just kind of like, I know Ty Cartier is like, he went after, who did it in the Flames game? Did he go after?
He went after Claude Giroux. Brendan Lemieux.
Brendan Lemieux.
Claude Giroux, right. Not the same person.
No.
I was mixing up Claude Lemieux with Brendan Lemieux and also Claude Giroux somehow. Yes. Brendan Lemieux. So
John's going to hit us with some information here. But it seems like I wasn't surprised.
That's him typing.
I wasn't surprised that at the end of the Vancouver game that it was Ty Cartier and Yanni Gourde. Those guys seem game to do that type of thing.
Yeah.
What I was happy to see is tonight it seemed like more like, okay, the whole line needs to get in there.
Yeah.
But anyway.
The results of that. Oh, do you have something from the supercomputer?
Well, I was just going to say Tanev has mixed it up.
Right? Tanev. Yeah.
Was it in the San Jose game that he fought somebody at the end, right?
He did.
Alexiak fought somebody.
Yeah.
Everly had to answer for his actions in the playoffs.
Kale McCarr never did.
Yeah, and then you mentioned Vince Dunn. Yeah. So.
The result of the hit on Tanev is that he has missed at least one game. I think I saw that he is on this road trip, so that's probably a good sign, but nonetheless, he's hurt. He also tried to come back, so I don't think it's like the longest term thing. I think what happened was when he went down, he smashed his knee on the ice. And I think he's probably, I don't know, I'm no doctor. But what is also very concerning is Jaden Schwartz left this Blackhawks game tonight. And it was weird because I went back and looked at it to try to like figure out what happened. There's no obvious thing. Like he doesn't get hit or anything. He's just kind of like limping on his leg all of a sudden. So that's never a good sign. You never want to. Never want to see that, especially when it's like something away from the play. That's...
Yeah, the no-contact lower body injury is always scary.
Schwartz has had a pretty good year.
He's been arguably their best player, so we don't want to lose him. Hopefully, Andrei Burakovsky's coming back soon. But man, these guys, over the last 2 years, right, they've stayed like relatively healthy in that they usually only have like one or two guys out at a time, but they never have the whole team. Right. Even back to the first year, they never have the whole team healthy. So I don't know. We'll see here. Hopefully Burakovsky comes back soon. He's still skating in a red sweater. They did call up Andrew Podorolski to replace Brandon Tanev. He played his first game as a Kraken on Tuesday against the Blackhawks. And they also called up Marian Studenich as, I guess, as depth. And now he may be needed because Schwartz left the game. So who knows? All right, let's do our weekly wager quick before we get to our interview. So, John.
Before we forget to do it.
Explain this to me like I'm five, because last time I didn't quite track, and I think you've already changed your plan here. Am I correct?
Yeah, we don't need to go into the previous renditions.
Right, because that didn't work.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
No.
Let's be honest.
We forgot about it. I'm going to call out three scenarios that could happen in the next week. You two are going to draft which ones you want.
All Kraken related?
Yeah.
And
they're
we...
all positive
okay,
events
so that we
for
can,
the Kraken.
So we can root for them.
Right.
Because that was one of the things last time was I was rooting for them to get fewer
like
than
over,
four
yeah.
points or something.
Yeah.
I was like, well, this sucks.
So, not fun. Not fun for wanting to win a bet, but also positive outcomes for the Kraken.
Correct.
Okay. So here are the three options. And then... What do we do? A dollar a week?
Something like that, yeah.
Because I'll take the third, whatever ones you don't take.
The leftovers. You'll take the scraps.
Now, none of them could hit.
Uh-huh.
And so then that goes into the pot. Like, if none of them hit, it goes into the pot, carries over the next week.
Got
and
it.
Theoretically, all of them could hit as well.
Okay.
So, okay. Here are the three options. Kraken pitched their first shutout of the season in the next three games. You got Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal.
Okay.
Okay. That's one. Kraken score 5 goals in a game in one of these next three games.
Okay.
That's number two. Number three is the Kraken take 4 out of 6 points remaining in these three games.
Hmm.
So I'm going to go to Curtis first.
Why?
Alphabetical.
By first name.
By first name.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how they usually do it. It's usually alphabetical by first name.
That's how the rosters are sorted.
I mean,
NHL.com.
All right, what are you taking, Curtis?
I'll take 4 out of 6 points.
Yeah, that's what I would have taken, too. All right, I'll do 5 goals or more in one of the next three.
The shutout seems...
The shutout that hasn't happened all
that
season.
That hasn't happened yet.
Oddly
I mean,
far.
The Canadians, I could see it.
Yeah, maybe.
We'll the Senators were just shut out in a game that we will talk about in a moment.
Mm.
Another pen.
And so, John, you get... Kraken shutout then. So
yes.
If, okay.
I love it.
All right. I like this. So what is mine? I don't remember what I picked. 5 goals. I'm looking for the 5-goal free-for-all, which...
5-goal free-for-all.
What does that give you? It gives you 32% off.
On like 4 specific days. Although, John, you took advantage of this 32% off to go to Colorado, right?
Yeah. They choose your location.
Yeah.
No free ads.
I didn't mention the airline.
I know. And but the Badgers, we're going to go into a Badger... They had a 5-goal free-for-all. If the Badgers scored 5 goals, everybody in the arena got free ice cream at Culver's.
Oh.
So once it got to 4 goals, we'd always chant, "We want ice cream." So, which is a good transition into our interview with Blake Jeffrion and Sam Jeffries.
We now welcome on to Sound of Hockey two very special guests. The first is a former professional hockey player who became the first Wisconsin Badger to win the Hobie Baker Award in 2010, and he played 35 NHL games with the Predators and the Canadiens before having his career cut short. He has an absolutely fascinating story to tell. The other is his biographer and author of the new book, Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion, and The Fastest Game on Earth. I'm proud to say these are two fellow Wisconsin Badgers, just like myself. Welcome to the show, Blake Jeffrion and Sam Jeffries. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Darren. Thanks for having us.
My first question, and this is really for both of you, Blake, I'll let you take it first. Is Wisconsin men's hockey back?
Absolutely. Me and Sam were up for a game for, I think it was last month. And look, I've always said, Badger hockey is hard-nosed and in your face. And I actually truly don't care about the result. Look, I do. But intimately, I think if we play Wisco hockey, which is hard-nosed in your face, combined with a little bit of skill and a great power play, great goaltending and defensive play and structure, we're going to be successful just because that's what the crowd feeds off of. That's what gets the fans back in the building. And ultimately, when people come into our own, it's very difficult to beat us there. And then we ride that wave of confidence throughout and out onto the road. Yeah. So to answer your question in short, yes, Wisco's back. I think Mike Hastings has done an absolutely incredible job of changing the culture and demanding work ethic as the first prong, and then implementing a quick second of not only work hard, but work smart. And as a result of that, we've climbed the ranks all the way to number one, now settled back in probably where we probably should be, top five, six, seven, top 10. But yeah, really excited about where the program's headed.
Sam, same question to you.
Well, I don't think it's a coincidence that ever since the book about the last national championship run published, the Badgers have been winning. So, Blake and I were in Madison a few weeks ago. We got to spend some great time with Coach Hastings, and I sent him a book after as a thank you for hosting us, and may have been a gentle suggestion to make it required reading for his players and recruits. I think if he takes me up on it, they might as well put the trophy in the case right now.
Yeah, and I personally haven't gotten to read the whole book yet. I did get to read a couple of chapters here as I was getting ready for the interview. And Sam, I have to say your descriptions of the Madison campus there really took me right back. It was pretty cool to read. Blake, you were raised in Tennessee and you played at the National Team Development Program, and then you end up playing under Mike Eaves at Wisconsin. I'm curious, coming from where you were raised, what drew you to Wisconsin?
Yeah, that was a great question. So a couple things. I told this story yesterday to some people, and so I always wanted to go to Michigan, actually. Growing up as a kid in the South, you only got access to the games on ESPN, which were very few, far between. Which is essentially the national championship game or the Michigan-Michigan State rivalry game. And we used to always see those helmets, and everyone wanted those helmets, right?
Yeah.
That combined with Red Berenson was actually the head coach and a good family friend of ours and a former roommate of my grandfather's when he played for the Rangers. And so Kyle, those two combinations was I'm going to Michigan. And ultimately, my head coach when I played for Team USA was a guy by the name of John Hines, who was a former assistant coach under Mike Eaves.
He's in the news right now.
Yeah, just got the coach, and I just texted him last night, the Minnesota Wild new head coach. Good yeah. for him. And so he was my coach. They had very similar strategies, styles of play, type of player they liked, et cetera. And I was kind of that mold. And, my dad was like, look, why don't you just go see one, two last schools, and then you can ultimately decide. And one of those was Wisconsin. You wrap in the education, the Kohl Center, the atmosphere, the tradition, the winning culture, Mike Eaves, his style of play. The wonderful campus of Madison combined with the extracurricular activities at night in the college club, I think it's kind of a winning equation and a no-brainer, frankly.
Yeah.
And it was kind of fit my personality too. I lived in Ann Arbor for 2 years and kind of wanted to change of pace. You can only go to the Brown Jug so many times, and it was Madison was it was a no-brainer for me. It kind of slapped me in the face, frankly.
Yeah. And so, do you just despise Michigan now?
I will tell a funny story. I hope Red's listening. I love Red. So I'll tell you a story. So when I called three coaches when I finally said I'm going to go to Wisconsin. The first one I called was Rico Blase, who at the time was the University of Miami, Miami University head coach. And he said, Blake, best of luck to you. Wisconsin's a great school. Mike Eaves and his staff does a great job. I wish you nothing but the best of luck. You need anything ever, on or off the ice, you call me and it's done. Class act, the whole thing. I then called Red, and Red goes, I tell him the whole thing, go through my spiel, And he essentially yelled back, "You're making a massive, a monumental mistake, and I feel so disrespected." Click. I never spoke to Red until after I graduated college. Well, I will tell you, gentlemen, the story goes, the first game I played at University of Michigan, my best friend is a guy by the name of Chris Summers, who I played USA with. And that was the year they had Porter and Kolarik, and I think Porter won the Hobey Baker that year. And they had the same play every time where they would, you know, Porter would just sit back door and they would score back tap-ins pretty much. And after Friday night, I made a mistake, like totally forgot to put my stick in one area. Porter scores a goal. The next morning on Saturday morning, there's a video session and there's Red Berenson be like, "Who do you guys think this is a great play, but whose mistake do you think this was?" And he circles me for like 10 seconds and he just keeps circling me. And he knows that I'm best friends with Chris Summers and he knows this is going to get back to me. Well, gentlemen, let me tell you, from then on out, I had the most points per game against Michigan. I scored like a goal and assist the next night. And I literally, every time I scored or got a goal against them, I'd stare Red down on the bench. And I saw him like after I graduated, like I think he actually called me when I won the Hobey Baker. And he's like, "I never should have done that video session, should have I?" And I said, "Nope." I go, "But I thank you for it as well." So that's a little insight. And then I called Mike Heaves, of course, and said, "Hey, coach, I want to come to Wisconsin." He's like, "We'd love to have you. Open arms. Let's go. Be ready to work and look forward to getting you here." Yeah. So that was kind of how that went.
And that was Mike's reputation, right? He was a real taskmaster, and I think it really depended on the personality if you were a good fit to play there. Did you see that kind of, I guess, drive to be the best physically? Did you see that as a selling point, though, for Mike Heaves?
Good question. I don't know if it was necessarily a selling point, but I just loved the Herb Brooks culture. Mm-hmm. That's what I thrived in, you know. You know, if I'm being real honest, I actually hated to do that work. It was like I always dreaded it. But then once I got into it and started doing it, I loved it. And then the after effects, right, is, you know, it's when you go run a mile really fast and after you're like, "Oh, I feel great now. Let's have a beer," you know. Like that was what I loved. And I think that that's what I needed at that time as an immature kid, not knowing, you know, a whole lot in life. I needed someone to continue to push me like that.
And I know at one point in the book, there's a reference to you giving him some feedback as the captain of the Badgers. Did that go pretty well?
That went extremely poorly, actually. I think the net effect was a positive one. But, you know, the story goes, you know, essentially that I was we had a young team. We had a lot of freshmen and a lot of guys, even in my class, the year I became captain. And, you know, Ever loved to just kind of rip into you a little bit if you weren't playing up to his standards. And it wasn't personal. It wasn't because he was egotistical and wanted to win every game. He was truly trying to help you. And I think that speaks volumes of his character, of who he is as a human being and whatnot. And I just kind of realized, like, man, like not everyone's like me or like that style. And I thought that it would be a value add to our team if, you know, he got to know some of those guys who couldn't handle that and approach it a different way on how to lead them and help them and entice them and push them. And so I made that recommendation one morning or at a lunch with him, where he, you know, got up and stormed off and left me with the bill and was pretty rattled that I had said that to him. And I said it in a respectful way, of course, but it was just an observation, you know, but coming from a 20-year-old kid, when you've, you know, done as much as you have in his career as a coach, you're probably like, "Dude, are you kidding me?" And so, you know, but I will say, and this is the type of person Mike Heaves is he reflected on it. He thought about it. Usually he'll tell you he talks to Bethy, which is his wife. And he came back the next morning and called me like 6 a.m. I was like, "Hey, get to my office." And he apologized, paid me back the like $35 that I couldn't afford. And I had to call my dad and take it out like on the credit card. And And gave that back to me and was like, "Hey, like, I thought about what you said. I think you're right." And from then on, two gentlemen, John Mitchell and Aaron Bennigsen, had career years that year and the following year. Mm-hmm. And essentially how it went was I said to him, I was like, "Just leave those guys alone. I got them. If they're dragging ass, let me handle it. I'll get into them. You stay away from them and just keep them, you know, with positivity." And I think Aaron Bennigsen, his last year, scored like 15 goals as like a third, fourth liner, like, you know, and all it was just a little bit of, you know, positivity and leave him alone and let him do his thing.
Yeah. You guys had a heck of a team there. We crossed paths a little bit. I was there effectively 1 year ahead of you. So freshman year was the year they won the national championship for me. Sophomore year you arrived and then that was quite the quite the group that you had. So I love that you guys talked about the college club too in the book, and you already referenced it. I spent a few nights there. It wasn't my go-to spot, but what was your...
What was, you don't mind me asking.
Mine was the Blue Velvet, because that was where like my...
Dude, so the Blue Velvet was our spot on Sunday nights.
Right. So we'd run into you guys there every now and then. Because we knew guys that worked there, so I had a very baby face. That was the only place I could get into.
Joe the bartender?
Yep. Yes, I knew him well. He once told me if I ever light myself on fire in his bar again, he'll never let me come back. So that's a true story. That's a one for another day, perhaps. What was your favorite night at the college club? Did you have one?
He did meet his wife there, so not to preempt your story, but
I wasn't going to say that. So
I know you weren't. I'm trying to help you out.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I had a lot of great nights there. You know, obviously what Sam just alluded to, meeting my, you know, I had met my wife previously, but it was the night of the college club where I essentially held onto the railing and would not leave until I got her number. While the bouncers tried to pull me away from in the bar, and I held on with every mite of energy that I had. And the greatest part about that story is I confirmed that it actually was her number before I actually left, which is a veteran move.
Nice. Veteran and, move.
You know, but I will say that, you know, there was a time, you know, we used to always, you know, we were very fortunate to have a private plane when I went to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And there was, if we played really well and whatnot, coach would get us back home in time for bar time. And coming off a sweep, or, you know, our deal was kind of 3 or 4 points, we were able to take that trip back in time. Those are always great, great nights. Michigan Tech, which was like an hour and a half, 2 hour flight, tough barn to play in. They always played their ass off, like tough, really tough atmosphere to play in. And, you know, we would always, you know, get back in time for that one. And the boys were always like, it was funny. Like once we dangled the carrot, I came up with this ideology, like, I think it was my second half of my junior year into my senior year, which was the deal I cut with coach was if we win 3 of 4, we don't bag skate at all, and we get a flight back in time to get back in time for bar time if we can make it. I was like, and we're saving the university money.
Yeah, because you don't have to stay overnight. That's great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. So if you can't tell, I'm a negotiator by now. anyway, so I think the other thing, you know, there was also another time the KK that we used to always do our Super Bowl parties there, and those were always an absolute blast. So
a little more dignified than when I was there 3 weeks ago and Blake and I were back for the book signing, and I got a buddy who's trying to trade signed books for shots. And he goes, "No, we're not going to pay for this round, but this guy, this is a first edition. He'll sign it for you." I'm like, you know, I'm not in college anymore. We might need to find another spot to hang out.
Yeah. My buddy was there just last weekend, and he learned that there's a, they have a VIP card that there's only 20 made. And if you have the college club VIP card, you get to skip the line for life, apparently. But there's only 20 of them in existence. So you don't happen to have one of those, do you, Blake?
I do not, but okay. I'll just call Jordo and just get a full
You'll get in.
Speed.
Yeah. Yeah. You have your way in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Sam, what made you want to even write this book? I mean, I'm fascinated by it, the story and the journey. We talk a lot about journeys on this podcast, but what gave you the inspiration? Why did you reach out to Blake to do this book?
Yeah, I have a long connection to the Wisconsin hockey program. I had a couple of uncles play hockey for Badger Bob back in the 70s during the Bob Johnson, Herb Brooks rivalry. And, you know, I grew up going back to the state and having my trips to the Kohl Center be, you know, really the pinnacle of my family visits. And so when I went to school there, got season tickets and ended up watching Blake for 3 years and followed his career after. And I thought there was always so much more to it, knowing the history of his family, the fact that he was the, you know, not only a fourth generation NHLer, but a, you know, a homegrown product of the American South who ends up going to play for his hometown team. I mean, it's serendipitous in a, you know, it's like Charles Dickens couldn't make this up, right? But then I started to dig more and more, and I realized that I didn't know the half of it. And there was so much more to Blake's story and to his journey. His time at Culver Military Academy, and then, you know, the time at the NTDP, we were talking about Mike Eaves, and I think a lot of folks don't realize that after the Miracle on Ice, USA Hockey was not in a good place. And, you know, by the mid-90s, the stats in the book, but there were more players from the province of Ontario in the NHL than there were American-born players you know, in the entire league. And there was a real push to try and fix that. And they, you know, it really took a very small handful of guys with a dedicated vision, 44 players year round in Michigan, you know, skating together, playing together, traveling together, to build up that elite core that would hopefully be, you know, the basis for future, future international winning teams. And it was not going very well. I mean, that stuff takes time to build, and it was very precarious. And a lot of folks wanted to pull the plug. They felt they were investing too much money in too few kids. And it was Mike Eaves winning the gold medal, at the U18s in 2002, and then the World Juniors in 2004, and then the team that Blake played on in 2006 that won the gold medal that really cemented it. And I think the folks who were close to it never felt that that was safe. You know, that is a program, as a concept, was safe until Blake went through it and ended up winning that gold medal in 06. And then from there, I mean, you guys know it, but the World Juniors tournament, all the IIHF tournaments have become, you know, a premier tournament for the cream of the college crop, even the American guys playing in the Canadian juniors to play. So just things like that, I thought were so incredible about Blake's story. And I don't think that he realized until I was able to lay them out for him. And then similarly with some of the Canadians' history that, you know, you've got, there's one hockey guy who I spoke to who said, you know, it's kind of like the Irish, the Canadians treat Canadian expats kind of like the Irish treat Irish expats. And they saw the Jeffrey on name coming back to Montreal. And really, that was such a moment for them. And you know, then starting to talk to Blake and realizing, you know, as he was growing up, when he realized that his grandfather was, you know, was a generational superstar and a pioneer of the sport. And then it was just Tetris, right? And putting it together and had a wonderful conversation with John Hines that Blake set up. I'm feeding my kids chicken nuggets and talking to the head coach of the New Jersey Devils. But, you know, really ended up being a real privilege to be able to tell the story.
I know you're a history major. Does this kind of like scratch the itch for you a little bit? That's not what you do in your day-to-day life. I know that. So yeah. Is that like just, you know, you wanted to dig into something and just like really learn about it? Was that a big part of it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And the cool part is I've lived some of this history, right? And right. All of us were on campus in Madison, and I could feel this change in the college game as players left earlier and the fan base started to feel less attached. And I didn't really understand why. And it wasn't until researching this book and really getting into, you know, that first lockout and the implementation of the salary cap and the speeding up of the game and the pocket picking of the college game that I really understood this thing that I could feel happen in real time. Now looking back, you know, 15 years later and realizing that there were bigger forces at play and it was, you know, it was having an impact on the life I was living.
And I love how you described hockey in Tennessee, right? I think you paint an excellent picture of what that was like, you know, theoretically when Blake moved there and before the Predators came in, right? Because I before Kraken, I was kind of a Sharks and Predators fan. I've been to games in Nashville. I love the atmosphere there because you feel like you're seeing hockey in Nashville, and it's great. It's a great atmosphere. But Blake, you know, you moved there, I think, when you were one or something and theoretically grew up playing there, you know, for at least 10 to 12 years or something before you had to go off. But yep. Tell me about playing hockey in Nashville and then kind of the arrival of the Predators and what that meant to the area as far as youth hockey goes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it meant everything. I mean, when I was growing up there, we had the Nashville Knights, which was an IHL team. And it essentially was a handful of skilled players and a lot of fighters. I mean, that's what the National Knights games were. You know, we had the National Knights Arena that we very, very rarely skated or played at. And then we had the Centennial Ice Sports Complex, which at the time was only one sheet of ice. So we got practice two times a week, half sheet of ice, one of the practices, and then a full sheet of ice the other. And then when the National Predators moved there, they built, you know, the National Knights went away. That rink got folded into like a small concert venue. And we were left with one sheet essentially. And the Predators had full like Rofer on the ice until they had built their new facility and their secondary sheet of ice that they could, you know, have themselves. And then ever since then, man, I think there's like almost 20 sheets of ice now in just the Nashville area, which is absolutely insane. I remember as a kid, like when the Predators, you know, like their first game, I was there. I mean, I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And I think ever since then, man, I mean, you look at the Nashville market, like obviously the economics of the healthcare, you know, world moving there and all these jobs and whatnot, but you know, it's been fruitful. But I mean, everyone loves Nashville there. I think The ownership group has done a great job on you know, branding and marketing, and you know, a lot of wealth has moved there, which, you know, hockey's an expensive sport. They've also, you know, some of the early executives of the Predators and Gary Bettman and Bill Daly and them have done a great job of, you know, they incorporated street hockey first and evolved into gear donation programs to get kids involved. I mean, I rented my gear until I was like 8 or 9 years old, you know, from the local rink. So, I mean, and it was all donations. So it was, you know, it was pretty special and pretty cool. And just to see the evolution of what's happened to the game of hockey in the South inside Nashville, the city of Nashville, and all of that is kind of all surrounded by the Predators and has their DNA written all over. It's pretty amazing, frankly. It really is.
Darren alluded to it a little earlier that your career got cut short by a terrible injury that happened in an AHL game kind of during the lockout when that was your spot to play. Yep. You were playing for the Hamilton Bulldogs during the lockout. What do you remember about that night?
I remember everything. I just told the story yesterday. I mean, look, I remember my mom and dad were flying up to Boston to watch my brothers play. They're going to drive over the border and come watch me play in Montreal. We were doing it was during the lockouts. So they wanted the Montreal Canadiens organization wanted to hold a game inside the Bell Center for the fans of Montreal. So we all drove there and we were playing. It was early in the first period. Mom and dad were in the stands. You know, puck gets turned over inside the blue line. I'm heading up the left wing side. And, you know, Jean-Pierre Côté comes over and gives me a hip check. I try to jump out of the way last minute. My head goes one way, a skate goes the other, or comes up, hits me in the side of the head. You know, I'd suffered 13 document concussions in my career. So anywhere from getting my bell rung to be completely knocked out. So I know what a concussion feels like. And of course, yes, I've had way more than that. Now that I know what, you know, those feel like. So when I went down, you know, I, you know, just sat there for a second. Usually when I get a concussion, my peripheral vision goes, so it looks like I'm looking through straws essentially. And, you know, I stood up, I was on my knees, kind of came up, and you know, everything was fine. Kind of a scrum or a fight breaks out. And then I felt a warm sensation go down my back, which is a bunch of blood. I stand up, I skate up the ice with my head kind of down, you know, I meet my trainer on the bench who puts a towel over my eye because he thinks I'm, you know, I got a lot of blood on my face. Go back to the trainer's room. There's a lot of trainers and team docs running around speaking French that I don't know a lick of.
Oh, yeah.
So I had no idea what's going on. Yeah. And next thing you know, the doc comes over, looks at me and says something, and everyone started moving even faster. And, you know, next thing you know, I'm in a stretcher in an ambulance. My mom and dad are with me down from the tunnel. You know, we're into the ambulance and off to the hospital pretty quickly. The doc looks at me and goes, hey, you'll be out in 20 minutes. Just want to make sure that everything's okay. You know, this is more precautionary more than anything. Going into the CAT scan room, that's the last thing I remember. I blacked out, passed out, and the punchline was I had a depressed skull fracture and I had internal bleeding going on. And I had 7 pieces of skull embedded in my brain, which is kind of a problem. I woke up. I woke up like the next, I think it was the next day. You know, there was plate and 5 screws put in and, you know, still kicking. So when they ask, when people say, are you hard headed? I said, you goddamn right I am.
Yeah. And how are you feeling these days with everything? Are you obviously still feeling the effects a little bit?
No, I mean, I feel great, man. You know, I've been a long time since it's happened. I think I'm in, you know, feeling great. Haven't had any like, you know, setbacks really. You know, the recovery in the first 18 months after the injury was very, very, very difficult for me, both mentally and physically, but feeling good now. Really am.
Yeah. I know we're just about out of time, so we haven't even really touched too much on your lineage, but so your great-grandfather is Howie Morans, your grandfather is Boom Boom Jeffrion, your dad is Dan Jeffrion, who also played in the NHL. My last question for you, Blake, is just –
there has to be, when you get to Montreal, right, there has to be some sort of like added pressure. Did you feel that when you got there as part of that organization, that that the fans are just like looking for you to bring back some of that spark from the past?
You know, I don't think I felt pressure. I think what I felt, I mean, maybe a little bit, but I think what I felt more than anything was like, maybe it is pressure, but I felt more like nervous, you know, like that I had to play. And what I had a hard, really hard time with was I didn't play my game. I was trying to be a player that I really wasn't, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that was an adjustment period I had to go through very quickly. And like when I reflect back, like it was a mistake that I made. You know, I tried to be this goal scorer and this, you know, kind of like you said, right? Maybe it is a little bit of pressure, but I should have just played who I was and been who I was. And hey, if you like me, great. If you don't, great. Like this is who I am, this is the player that I am. I think I got a little outside of who I was as a player, you know, looking back on it.
Yeah. Well, this has been awesome. Sam, where do we find the book?
Yeah, anywhere books are sold. Find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org. It's around, and if you're in the Seattle area, I'm happy to sign one for you. We'll meet up at the Angry Beaver at Kraken game and give my autograph.
I love it. Well, thank you both so much for your time. Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffery and the Fastest Game on Earth is the name of the book. Go check it out. Like I said, I've read a couple chapters. I can't wait to read the rest of it. Thank you very much, Sam Jeffries, Blake Jeffery on. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Darren.
All right. Thank you again to Blake and Sam. I think that was a really interesting interview. And we could have gone so long, I think, talking about them because I read the book. I mean, I've still only gotten to read a couple chapters, but really fascinating story about Blake Jeffery on that I never really knew, even though I watched him for three of my 4 years at Wisconsin pretty closely, right? I didn't know this
well, and
story.
I could have talked to him for an hour about Nashville in general, right? Yeah. We barely scratched the surface at that, you know, obviously, because when I was doing this grassroots effort, there was a lot of, you know, if you bring it here, the sport will grow. And that's clearly what's happened in Nashville. And it's just remarkable that he's come out of Nashville as an NHL player in general. Like, I'm not sure if there's any others from Tennessee that have played in the NHL yet.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
We might have to look that up.
Okay. I will look it up. But
so here's some fun facts about Blake Jeffery that we didn't really touch on because there is so much to talk about with him. And mostly I just wanted to talk about the college club in Madison.
Yeah.
But he was born in Florida, raised in Tennessee. He won the Hobey Baker Award in 2010. He's the first Wisconsin Badger ever to do that. Quick, let's get quizzical. Do you know who's done it since him?
Not Caulfield, was it?
Yeah, it was Cole Caulfield.
All right. Cool.
The Badgers won the national championship my freshman year, the year before he got to Wisconsin. And then he was the captain that led them back to the national championship as his senior year. They lost that game to Boston College. That team had Ryan McDonough, Derek Stepan, Brendan Smith, Craig Smith, and Seattle Kraken's Justin Schultz on the team.
Wow. Oh, wow.
What a team.
Against the Boston College Eagles, which had Chris Kreider, Cam Atkinson, and Jimmy Hayes. So... yeah. He was selected 56th overall in the second round, again, by his hometown Nashville. First player ever from his hometown. Retired at 25 after the incident we talked about earlier. He's the first fourth-generation NHL player. Hmm. His great-grandfather was Howie Morans, who's a Hall of Famer. He was considered the best player of the first half of the 20th century, I think. Like the 1900s. So Howie Morans died at 34 after he broke his leg in four places and they had an undetected blood clot. They retired his jersey and he like laid in, what do they call it? When a king is like laid out for people to view him. They did that at like the old Montreal, was it the Forum? Is that the arena? Yeah. Right. Yeah. So like all the fans like came by and like paid their respects. His grandfather was Bernie Boom Boom Jeffery on, who won 6 Stanley Cups, also a Hall of Famer. Invented the slap shot, literally invented the slap shot. And then his father is Dan Jeffery on, who played, I think it was 3 NHL seasons for the Canadiens and the Jets. So just a fascinating, fascinating story. And I can't wait to read more about that. I wish we could have gone on and on with him because I had a lot more questions that I think I could have asked, but we just had kind of limited time.
And again, I'm only like a third of the way through, but the book is written very well. I just love how he painted the picture of Nashville, like when the Jeffreyans moved there.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the hockey landscape, which was pretty non-existent. Mm. But it's a great, I think it's really well written, you know, like, it was just a great conversation.
Yep.
Interesting story. So
let's move on to our segments and our first segment.
Real quick.
Yes, John.
There have not been any Tennessee-born players in the NHL since at least 1990.
Right, and he was not born in Tennessee.
I know that. So that's the one thing that lacks the data. We don't know
where he's raised.
If somebody
where
has people played are raised, somewhere. Yeah.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
The more you know. The more you know.
We now move on to our segments. and our first segment is Bad Boys. Ryan Hartman was suspended for a slew foot, 2 games. On Alex DeBrincat. It was a pretty blatant one.
And he's done it before.
Yeah. He definitely got him pretty good. Dangerous play.
Yeah.
Jacob Trouba was fined $5,000. Did we have a pin in Jacob Trouba from earlier or no?
Not a pin, but we did talk about him.
He was aforementioned. He took a real good swing at Trent Frederick, which he's on your Boston Bruins. Did you have any thoughts on this one, Curtis?
What? Well, I mean, I watched the video. Actually, John has watched it more closely. I think maybe he can explain it. But,
it looks vicious.
Vicious slash to the head. I mean,
like McSwirley-esque
play.
Right?
Yeah. And I was a little surprised it only ended up in a fine, but you thought maybe it was because...
So there was other angles of it, and it shows that Trent Frederick is holding Trouba's arm, like restraining it, and then he lets go, and then that kind of projects... Like, ultimately, he still got fined. Like, so let's be clear. It's, like, still a mistake. And ultimately, you need to control the actions of your stick. But it doesn't look nearly as intentional as it did from kind of the angle that's getting circulated around the internet. So
the Jacob Trouba is a clean player narrative is getting just more and more difficult.
That guy stinks, man. he's really good. And he staples players on the boards all the time. And it's nasty. But
he stinks.
He's effective. He's effective, yeah.
So
he stinks as he smells, but he's a really good hockey player.
it's like an old-timey sea captain.
Yeah.
He's a captain. Like smelly.
You stink, man. No, I'm really good. No, but like as a person, you stink.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of like what we were hearing up in Vancouver.
Yeah. You got him good, John. You got his ass.
Yeah.
Okay, and then our last Bad Boys is perhaps
emphasis on boys.
Yeah, perhaps an extended version here. So here's the pin.
We're taking it out.
Pin has been removed. We all just made the motion to remove the pins. It's officially been removed. The Corey Perry situation. So he took a leave of absence from the team, and the Blackhawks said that it was management's decision, and Corey Perry's agent said that it was Corey Perry's decision. He was stepping away for personal matters. Then all of a sudden, and I don't know, nobody knows where this came from, but this really crazy rumor started getting created on the internet. And I was just like, well, that's stupid. There's obviously no merit to that. And then on Tuesday, and this is where the internet, I think, got really wild, is the Blackhawks put out a really vague statement saying that he'd been put on waivers for reason of terminating his contract because of conduct that they thought was completely unacceptable. Now, all of a sudden, that rumor really took off. And I think this is where people started to like believe the rumor was something that had actually happened. And so all of a sudden, the internet was just ablaze with... we don't want to say what the rumor was, but it was a lot. It was a lot today. And eventually they finally had a press conference that said, hey, I just want it to be known that this has nothing to do with any other players or any of their families. And that effectively dispelled the rumor to some degree. But here's what I wanted to talk about on this, though, because I really don't want to talk about the rumor. And we still don't know what Corey Perry has actually done to earn himself this dismissal from the team. Do you guys think that the Blackhawks handled this like quickly enough, knowing what was happening out there in the public opinion? And what I mean by that is I felt like they had a real good opportunity to nip this in the bud really fast when it started to like spiral out of control. And when they put out that statement, it really threw fuel on a stupid fire, a very, very stupid fire that then got really out of control because of the statement and the way that they worded it. I felt like if they had just come out with that statement and said, this has nothing to do with other players in that statement, that would have put the whole thing to rest. But instead, because they were so vague, it really spiraled out of control. That was what I thought about it.
Well, it probably could have been better, but at the same time, like, we still don't know what the issue is.
That's true.
And there could be some legal issues to kind of keep it vague, which they
it vague. They said it's not a legal issue.
And we kind of talked about this earlier today, is like, you know, plenty of companies do not comment on rumors or speculation.
Of course, yeah.
And they do that because if some of those are right or accurate, they don't want to say, not dispel those, right? And deny those. Because then it's all of a sudden saying, oh, well, that one must be true because they're not denying it. Yeah, they could have done it better. I also am a little, I don't know how to think. I don't know why we think we are entitled to know what happened.
And it's fair.
And I'm not saying you're saying that.
Yeah.
You're not saying that. But
I definitely want to know what happened.
I mean,
just because
people
I'm curious.
Do, but yeah. Like, we are not entitled to it. Right.
If I agree.
If one of us were to get fired at our jobs, do you think our listeners should know? Right?
No, but listeners also don't know about my $4 million a year paycheck that I make. You know what I mean?
Does that matter then?
Which I don't, for the record.
No, but does
that
matter?
Be clear.
Does your salary matter?
No, I just think it's different. Like, I don't think you can compare a professional hockey team that's like so in the public eye, and that the like everything is made public about how much money you make, about I twisted my ankle. Hey, he's not going to be able to do his job this week, and people talk about that. You know what I mean? Like, it's just different. It's a different situation.
It is different, but I think I don't know if everything, we're entitled to know everything about people.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I agree.
I think I agree with like your reaction to the situation, John, and also your concern about like, is the public even entitled to know these types of things? My only like kind of devil's advocate kind of reaction to this is, you know, without getting into the rumor, it has like kind of future of the team implications.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like makes me think back to, if you're not going to be a contending team, your sole focus has got to be to preserve and develop the thing that can make you a contending team down the road. And if you're not keeping your eye on that ball, you know, it's like, what are we even doing here?
Right.
And so, again, without going, we don't know what happened. But we do know the rumors that were out there and how the internet just had a field day with them. And so should they have known? Should they have like done something to nip this in the bud sooner? I'd say arguably yes. With that being said, I kind of agree with everything you said, John.
Yeah. It also freaks me out that we don't know. And then there's also other people involved. And I think about Corey Perry's spouse and child, right? And family, extended family too, that... We don't know what it is, right? And it's not just about Corey Perry, right? Which makes me nervous about everything. Like even when it first came out, right? Not the rumors, but when it first came out, and a lot of national media seemed to feel like they should know, or they're entitled to know. And, you know, like there's could be other parties involved here that are not inside hockey that we should be considerate about.
Absolutely. And at the end of the day, you want any organization, the Blackhawks in particular, to just like do the right thing, right? And hopefully they did here, and hopefully what they did behind the scenes was right. And we don't know that, and we don't need to know that, but you just kind of hope that.
And I think people are, it's hard to give them the benefit of the doubt right now.
Understandably
that said,
so. But
I think, I'd like to think they're doing their best, right? Not thinking about their history of doing what they think is the best, but, you know, hopefully they've turn things around and are trying to do things more appropriately.
So, yeah, I think if you think about like how they actually handled it, aside from nipping the rumor in the bud, they received a complaint, or at least notification of potential wrongdoing. They investigated it. They terminated the guy's contract. Like, I don't know what more you can really do without knowing.
Yeah, like the veteran leader on the team.
Yeah.
Like the guy that they brought
in. Just signed.
Yeah, that they overpaid for, just signed to be the veteran leader, and they moved on from him. So it seems like they're doing the right thing here. But
all right, let's move on.
Yeah.
We now move on to You Don't See That Every Day.
Ooh, healthy. You don't see that
every
day.
We got several use don't sees that every day. We had was there a goal scored on this Jonathan Quick play where he's playing with no glove on his? Oh yeah, he got scored on. The refs just didn't blow the whistle. They just said play on, and he kind of gets his hand out of the way too. He's got his hand up in the air like, hey, look, I'm not wearing my glove, and they're like, nope, sorry.
I think he touched the puck
With his arm, yeah, not so much with his bare hand. But
oh, maybe I got to rewatch it because
you don't see it every day. We also had an interesting scenario in a Flames versus Predators game where a linesman named Tyson Baker tried to dive in to catch the head of Dennis Gilbert as he was falling to the ice after the fight, which I thought was pretty cool. Shout out to that linesman for doing that. I don't think he quite caught him.
I think he
might have slowed him down at least a little bit.
Prevented a bit, yeah.
And then we had the big one, which was so this was a pin earlier. Florida against Ottawa. This was the game where Ottawa got shut out. Shut out. I said that like a Canadian. They had a big brouhaha at the end of the game, and the referees called, I believe it was 4 minutes to one team, 2 minutes to the other team, and then everyone on the ice gets a misconduct. So.
And there are at least, if you watch the video of it, there are at least a couple guys that are just kind of like hanging on the periphery, holding people that are not doing anything.
It reminded me of like growing up, if my sister and I were like fighting in the backseat of the car, my dad would always yell at both of us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. They're like, I don't care who started it.
Cut it out back there, both of you. And I'm like, I am not doing anything wrong, right? And it's like, I don't care. I don't care.
And so to your point, so 106 penalty minutes were given out on this one play. But to your point... I think that's precisely what was going on, because there had been a kind of nasty incident before that with a misconduct where I think it was McEwen came over and took on Matthew Tkachuk. Both Tkachuks were right in the middle of all of this, but did a kind of nasty check to the head and then tried to punch up Matthew Tkachuk while he was on the ice. It was turning pretty nasty. So I think they kind of looked at it as a way to, well, if you don't have more than, 10 players on the bench each side, you got to straighten yourself out or you're not going to be able to finish.
Yeah,
this
there was
game.
Over 160 penalty minutes in that game. So it was spicy.
The benches at the end were pretty humorous. Oh, yes.
Yeah. We have one more. We have one more. The Spokane Chiefs goalie Dawson Cowan scored a goalie goal against the Portland Winterhawks. Really, he didn't score it, though. What happened was a shot from the point deflected off his glove, hit off the end boards, rattled around, and went all the way down to the other end and went into an empty net. So he got credit because he was the last player to touch it.
He didn't really celebrate it either.
Well, I don't know if he would have even known that he like got the credit.
I don't think. Even when I rewatched the replay, like the announcers were like, "Oh, that's got to go to so and so or whatever," and then they're like, "Oh, they're giving it to the goalie! Holy crap!" Yeah.
We now move on to everyone's favorite segment, and this one has a little bit of a twist on it because it's not Goalie Gear Corner; it's Goalie Gear Controversy.
That's not a thing.
That's good. I like that.
So Marc-Andre Fleury had his Native American heritage mask painted. It's an awesome, awesome mask, by the way. It's got some flowers on it for him, right? The Marc-Andre Fleury look. It's got the Minnesota Wild name written on it in a native language. I think this is the Mdewakanton Sioux Indian tribe, which is definitely around there. It's a tribe that I remember seeing their name quite frequently growing up. So I believe that's what the language is that it's written in. I'm sorry if I have that wrong. But it's just a really cool mask. Anyway, going on with what the NHL has been doing here, I know there was an incident earlier this season where somebody wanted to wear a purple ribbon as part of Hockey Fights Cancer on his mask. They said, no, you can't do that because it's breaking the rules that we set. Marc-Andre Fleury was told he can't wear this mask on Native American Heritage Night, which he wanted to honor his wife, who is, in fact, a Native American, or I guess a Native, maybe not American, but Indigenous, right? So he had this designed by, an Indian painter, like just ridiculous, ridiculous thing that they would say no to this, in my opinion. Of course, Fleury then says, well, I want to wear it anyway. What are you going to do? Kind of a thing. And then they went back on it and they let him wear it. So
I don't know if they let him wear it. They just didn't fine him for it, right?
Right. Which is kind of the same thing as like the Pride tape earlier this year, right? Where they're like, hey, you can't use Pride tape. And then somebody went out and just used Pride tape. Dermot. And they're like, yeah. And they're like, oh, okay, well, we're not going to fine you for it because we would look bad if we fined you for
it. What I don't understand is, I mean, all goalie masks have some personalization, right? Yeah. Like, Joey has a Swiss flag on his and a Canadian flag and an American flag. Like,
he's also got Sparky.
What's the difference, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, he's proud of his, I think his parents, one's from Switzerland, the other's from Canada, but he was born in the U.S. Like, what's the difference? He's proud of where, he came from, if you will. And how many, like Devin Levi also has the Star Wars stuff. And
then, not only that angle, but then with the initiative nights. I mean, Philip Grubauer has worn a Hockey Fights Cancer colored mast a couple times this month.
In Colorado.
So, I mean, you look at it from both angles. It's like, okay, celebrating personal heritage or a theme night.
Well,
both
those masks I think there was talk about like they shouldn't have been allowed to wear those. So, I mean, I'm really hoping Pride Month, somebody continues to push those boundaries, right?
Yeah.
I said it a couple times now, but I think if the Kraken are allowed to use purple ads on the boards, rainbow ads.
Well, all the league does the purple ads.
Oh, is that right?
Those are league-wide. But, I mean, I've thought about that.
Anyway.
Like, hey, they're not wearing the jerseys.
Right.
But what's preventing a goalie from even having a rainbow flag?
Mm-hmm. Rainbow goalie pads. They do have to get their gear like approved by the league, though, too. So that's literally what's stopping them. But anyway, that's our goalie gear controversy. We now move on to our weekly one-timers. Our first weekly one-timer. The Wild have fired head coach Dean Evason and assistant coach Bob Woods, and they quickly hired John Hines. Now, I am not really around the Wild campfire anymore, but I don't know. I just, like, I know they're off to a terrible start, but I think Dean Evason is pretty well-liked around Minnesota. I don't think people were happy about this firing by any means. I do think it has to do with the fact that Kirill Kaprizov and Matt Boldy have gotten off to, like, really bad starts this season, and they're not playing up to their standards, and some people think that's the way that Dean Evason is coaching them. So that could be part of it. The thing that I'm a little, like, confused about is I feel like John Hines got hired in this exact fashion in Nashville where, I don't know, was it Laviolette maybe was the previous coach? And it was like, he got fired and Hines was like right in the door the next day. And I'm like, is John Hines, like he's got an okay track record. He was pretty successful in terms of like wins and losses in Nashville. He wasn't good in terms of wins and losses in New Jersey. Is John Hines to you guys, like, is he like a get? Like, do you want John Hines as your next coach?
No. I mean, the only thing you can think is, does he bring a spark to like those players or some type of instant turnaround?
And maybe he will. You know, he absolutely might.
But is it a long-term inspiring choice? Not at all, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel too, but we'll see. I mean, I want to give him the benefit of the doubt, but that seems to be the sentiment, I think, around Wild fans. Like Dean Evason, he was a quirky dude. He was the guy that would like punch his assistant coaches after an overtime win and like he'd just say funny things in the media. Like, he is pretty well liked. So
pretty good record as a coach.
Yeah. Things didn't go his way this season. Our next weekly one timer. Patrick Kane signed with the Detroit Red Wings after a little bit of like a, would you call it a sweepstakes to try to land him?
Not really. I think he's a little old.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. It seemed like he was shopping around.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. I mean, less than five teams sound like we're in on him, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Probably the most interesting free agent out there, though. Is there another one like him sitting out there?
At this
Simmons.
Yeah, at this stage.
Wayne Simmons.
That's true. He's got 263 goals and 263 assists. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm fine with the Kraken passed on him.
We only care about this one from the...
Right, from the Daniel Sprong angle, which is that Daniel Sprong has been wearing number 88 this season. Patrick Kane is number 88. So,
and Daniel Sprong said he'd give it up. So,
yeah, just like that.
I don't think he'll be going to 91 in Detroit, but maybe.
Oh, right, because that was Sergei Fedorov's number.
Probably.
That's why he switched numbers, because he wore 91 last year.
Correct.
I didn't even connect that dot. That makes a lot of sense. Okay. Our next weekly one-timer. Samuel Girard has entered the player assistance program after he put out a statement basically saying like some mental health things had kind of led to alcohol abuse. So, if that is what's going on, obviously wishing him the best. He's a very good player. So,
man, Girard's probably my ninth most favorite defenseman in the league.
Ninth?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Behind.
Or should I say seven or eight?
Are you
eighth?
Oh, because he jumped over Makar.
No, because
I'm
Jacob,
definitely
Jacob Magna's number seven.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know Jacob.
And
Magna,
then it goes up the list.
I mean, yeah. Why not throw him in there?
You've talked about him on this podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I love Girard. I know he's not one of the elite defensemen in the league, but there was a time where they were talking about getting rid of him. And,
yeah. Because of his cap hit.
Yeah. And he's like, and I was just praying that he would somehow end on the Kraken.
Mm.
Obviously rooting for him.
Yeah.
Hopefully he identified he needed help before it got too bad. But We've seen plenty of players like use this program and get their self right. So I'm rooting for him. And hopefully he can get on the Kraken someday.
And he did do a good job of catching Dr. Richard Kimball in The Fugitive. So Sam Gerard.
I need to see that movie again.
The Fugitive?
Yeah.
That's a good movie.
I've heard it's great. And I saw it when movies weren't that.
And I think it holds up pretty well. I've seen it in the last couple of years. Like, it's still pretty entertaining. I don't know if it's like the most well-written movie of all time.
They use payphones in it?
They definitely do. And it's a big, it's a big part because they're like, I know where he is. He's by the L station.
The payphone by the, the gas station. Okay, cool.
Our next and final weekly one-timer. Anthony Beauvillier was traded from the Vancouver Canucks to the Chicago Blackhawks in the wake of the Corey Perry dismissal for a fifth-round pick. So I think the downstream thing here is that Vancouver seems to be clearing cap space, which I saw a thing that they might be interested in Zadorov, who has requested a trade out of Calgary. So maybe that's what's going on. I don't know. I've always liked the way Anthony Beauvillier plays, adds to Chicago. Anything else you want to say on that?
No, he can score goals. He's a good player.
Yep. Checking in on Kraken from seasons past, Jeremy Lauzon had a funny thing happen where he effectively got tagged in to have a fight. It's like somebody took a run in this Blues-Predators game, Shen, I guess, and then Lauzon does a line change and immediately goes after Shen. So that was pretty funny.
Yeah, it was pretty
loved
funny.
Loved it.
Yeah. That is, we have to do tweets of the week. Do you guys have tweets of the week?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'll go first. I have one. It comes from Pete Blackburn, who is a frequent tweeter of the weeker, but this one's not really about hockey. It just is from Thanksgiving Day football this past week. A lot of people were resharing the halftime show of Creed when they played at the Dallas Cowboys game, and they had like people flying around, aerial acrobats. And fantastic show, one that went down in infamy. And then it's just juxtaposed next to Jack Harlow, who's just like standing there kind of looking sad. And Pete Blackburn's tweet just says, "We used to live in a society." So that made me laugh real hard.
I was worried you were going to come after Dolly Parton. I was going to stand for it.
No, okay. But well, what did you think of that performance?
Dolly can do whatever the hell she wants, as far as I'm concerned.
It was a pretty good performance.
It was fine.
She was in the full Dallas Cowboys cheerleader outfit, which was, I thought, kind of great, personally.
Yeah, I saw people like somehow offended by that. I'm like, strange people.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
All right, John, why don't you go? I think we might have the same tweet of the week.
Okay, mine comes from ZJ Lang.
We do have the same precise tweet, okay. So you take it.
See, it's more relevant for me, because...
this is exactly...
So it's a picture of... the Florida Panthers bench late in the third period after the five guys got the 10-minute misconduct, and there might have been a couple other thrown out by then. But it says when your beer league team has a 10 p.m. ice time, and it's basically half the bench is empty, right? Because there's nobody there. So I love
spot
that.
On. It's spot on, except 10 p.m. is a downright reasonable time for a game for
here. Beer and league. We usually get 10 people for a 10 p.m. You know, sometimes it's like 7 or 8. That's when it really
stinks. So maybe
stinks.
He's saying like 10 p.m. is the ideal time, so therefore you would have a full bench.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah,
with one extra line. So
So I don't have another specific tweet, but there was also some funny tweets out there about Florida Panthers backup goalie Anthony Stolarz in this sequence, because you know a backup goalie is generally relegated to the very edge of the bench area, but with no one on the bench, he was just sitting
right
in the middle.
Right in the middle.
Someone handed him a player stick, and he was like,
I saw that. Yeah.
I could head out. He handed it right back, but he was having fun with it. So.
Very good.
I think I need one of you guys to close out the show. Because somebody has to sing the outro, so
that's not going to be this guy.
And that wraps up episode 263.
I don't think you need to shout like that.
Isn't that what you do?
Well,
that's
I don't know.
What you
I think
do
it's
constantly.
Oh man, I'm not going to remember all your outros.
It's all right, just you know, do your best and
don't forget to follow us on the Twitter.
Along to
thanks
escape.
To our Patreon members. Thanks to our listeners. Leave your 5-star review and we will read it on the next episode.
So let's go there. Let's make our escape. Come on, let's go there. Let's ask, can we stay? Can you take me higher? to a place where blind men see.
Oh my gosh.
Can you take me higher?